I mean, you know what, Pooja, when I do interviews in the UK, I think most people, it's so funny because most people want to hear your so-called very poetic story of you stood by a mother's stove learning how to put one spice at a time. Sorry to break that myth, but I did none of that.
I'm around 100 kilos of chocolate every single day and more than 100 kilos of sugar every day. I'm a pastry chef and sugar is my bread and butter and jam and Nutella. But I've decided to take those layers off with my brand new show. I'm talking to fellow chefs, entrepreneurs, my friends and mentors about the blood, sweat and all the other ingredients that go into making it in the food industry. I'm Pooja Dhingra and you're listening to my podcast, No Sugarcoat. This week, I'm talking to chef and author Monica Govardhan, who wrote the best-selling cookbook, The Indian Kitchen. A self-taught chef, Monica lives in the UK and specializes in authentic Indian cuisine. What time is it there?
It is 4 o'clock and I've literally just got home because I'm in a bit of a panic because I was supposed to actually have 8 friends over for lunch tomorrow and I haven't started cooking. So hence the panic of cooking lamb curry.
But your friends must be like super happy to have you in their lives. Lamb curry.
They are. But the problem is, Pooja, I don't get invited to that many dinner parties.
Oh, so all the pressure's on you.
And yeah, but I think people just get really worried about cooking for me. And I was actually invited to a barbecue recently on Sunday. And I was, I was so excited. There was just salad, there was barbecue lamb, and there was flatbread. And I was even just that excited the hell out of me.
Every time I go out, people are like, oh, how can we give you dessert? And I'm like, listen, I'm the easiest person on this planet.
Exactly. I think we're the easiest to please, actually speaking, if you ask me.
Yeah, we're easy to please. I'd like to believe that.
No, really. And I just think, even dal chawal will do me good,
Listen, dal chawal is the best thing on this planet. But
I know, we actually had it on Monday. There's dal chawal, lots of ghee, papad, pickle.
Oh, my God. So it's 9 o'clock. It's 9 o'clock here, so you're making me really hungry. So where are you? You're in London right now.
I'm at home in Newcastle. So we're about 2.5 hours from London.
And how long have you been there?
I've been in the UK for 17 years now.
17. Okay, so you're gonna take me back a little and start from the start.
I think I came to England essentially to do my degree in business. And
so you're originally from Bombay.
I'm originally from Bombay. I was born there. I was brought up there. Yeah, Bombay girl. And my parents, of course, lived in India. And I'd never been to the UK before I actually came over here, to do my degree. And I think the idea really was that I'd do my degree and then it would be a case of I'd go back, find a job, a proper job. And, get into finance.
What is
get
a proper
into
job?
Marketing. A proper job is a desk job, which you and me don't get to do.
So you're 17, you moved to the UK thinking,
dad's definition, by my dad's definition, proper job isn't what I intended on doing in food. So, yeah, even when I first got into food, he was like, get a proper job.
Wow.
One that'll actually pay you good money on a month-on-month basis. But, yeah, I mean, cutting the long story short, I did my business degree, but then I realized when I started working in London, I had more people from the office coming to my house to eat the food I cooked rather than talking about business or work or anything else. They'd literally just come because I had frozen curries in the freezer and I had, paratha that my mother would send me. And a few of them kind of randomly suggested I should start doing it professionally. And I'm not trained, so I'm self-taught. Yeah. So for me, it was quite daunting to think that people would even think of hiring me or taking me on to sort of professionally. But I think it kind of hit second gear when I met my husband and he was visiting. I was living in the city at that point because I was working in the city. And I wanted to move where he was, in Newcastle. And I literally just said, I'm going to quit my job. And he said, well, what do you want to do?
I remember the story. You met him at a party.
Yeah, and I said, I don't. He did, and I just said, I don't know what I want to do, and he was just like, well, you know what, I think you should cook, because you cook really well. And I don't think, even at that point, he was actually telling the truth. I think he was lying. he was just lying to woo me.
So cooking was something you did even before you moved to the UK, or?
I mean, I cooked when I met Bharat. I cooked essentially because tell you the truth, I really wanted to impress a man I was marrying. Okay, so simple as that. And I didn't know how to do that. And I also found that I was cooking for myself when I was actually living alone because I wanted to replicate the food that my mother actually cooked for us when we grew up. Now, I was living in London. I was a single girl and, you know, I just didn't have home-cooked food. And the closest I could get to it was actually getting a takeaway, which was nothing anywhere close to what I ate when I grew up. So yeah. I think even that for me kind of struck me a little bit, but I don't think I actually understood the basics of it when I actually was, you know, doing all of that. The doing bit was just doing because I had to do for sustenance. It wasn't a case of doing it because I felt like, okay, this is where I want to kind of see myself sort of doing stuff in food. But it's only when I got into it and I, to put half of my investment into my business, when I got married, because I'd saved a lot of money at that point. And I said, you know, I'm going to start this off and kind of get into food writing and, you know, cooking for events and for, you know, for clients, and I'll work as a private chef. When I look back, you know, even 5 years into my career in food, to be honest, Pooja, when I look back, I think, by God, like, I can join the dots and actually tell exactly what I did when I was growing up. You know, my mother would take me to the market in Dadar, and, you know, she'd like haggle for every single penny that she would actually buy vegetables. And, you know, we weren't a very well-off family. We just kind of managed based on budgets and, you know, whatever was in season, whatever was local, we'd actually use that. And I think she did it inherently. It wasn't because it was on trend or it was in fashion. So, I think for us, it was that. And then, you know, I mean, of course, my grandmother cooked a lot. So she entertained massively. She was a massive, massive, you know, she had a lot of enthusiasm for food. They used to actually go to that, I can't remember the name, the revolving restaurant on Marine Drive. And was it Natraj?
It's called Natraj. Ambassador?
Yeah, Ambassador. That's the one. Yeah, I mean, they used to go there, and I still remember in the 60s and 70s when they used to go there, my grandfather would actually tell the chef to come home on the Sunday and actually tell my mother how he cooked a certain dish.
No.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when I've heard all these stories, I actually think to myself, I think it was in a way inevitable that I were to get into food, to be fairly honest.
Yeah.
There was a book, and I don't know if it still exists. It's actually called Time and Talents. And my grandmother was one of the most prolific members of that club. And they actually got together and printed and published recipes. And wow. I have one of the, I'd say one of the 50 left copies from the 1960s. So I think, you know, when you think about all these things, you realize actually food was such a massive part of our upbringing. You know, I mean, I remember in hot summers, mom would make like prawn curry and, you know, we'd actually have fried prawns and, you know, just even the head would be used for the fried prawns, and I'd chew the head and get all the juice out, and even the shells of the prawns would be used to make stock. And,
yeah.
You know, I think my education in food started really young. And I think when I was 16 or 17 and, you know, we lived there in the 90s, it wasn't that cool to be in food.
Yeah. I mean, these are things that you just imbibe, right? Like recently I found like one of these, you know, slam books that we had from school.
Yeah.
And I had all these messages from my friends saying like, hey, we can't wait till you open your restaurant, or we can't wait to come to your chocolate shop. And this is like when you were 14, you know, and I was thinking of doing law.
Oh my
I was
God.
Like, was I even baking then, like that seriously?
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, like, when you can connect the dots. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You can actually tell. And I, you know, it's so funny because I remember when I used to be like 8, 9 years old, sometimes my mother would actually give me prawn pickle or, you know, to take to school. And imagine how embarrassing that would be for us.
Yeah.
I mean, it was the best. I kid you not, Pooja, it was the best prawn pickle. And her recipe is the best damn prawn pickle I could ever have. But to be honest, like as an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, my food was totally uncool. Even going to Sindhudurg and Dadar, I mean, when I took a few of my friends when I was younger in my teens, it was like, where the hell are you taking us?
Now it's
like,
super cool to go to Sindhudurg.
Oh my God, you're telling me that? You know what I mean? So yeah. I think for me, it was always that was for me, you know, eating at Prakash, for me, Dadar was like
I think I've grown up in Dadar, but I've only gone to these places thanks to you.
I mean, even for me, I think I thrive on street food, because even when I was like in my teens, you know, I flitted between Bombay and Pune, and I didn't have that much money. So, you know, vada pav was so cheap. So yeah. For us, it was always like going for like a 2 rupee vada pav, all those little crispy bits that they would fry along with the little chilies. And, you know, the vada and the pav, and, you know, just a few bites of that along with a nice hot cup of chai. Imagine that.
Did you ever have karvas?
Yeah, of course I had karvas.
Oh my God, I love karvas. It's the best thing
I mean,
ever.
I'm Maharashtra, so I think for me it was all kind of, you know, on my doorstep, because I lived, of course, in the west of India.
Yeah.
But I think, to tell you the truth, again, you know, I had neighbors who were Punjabi. I had friends who were Sindhi. You know, going on a Sunday to somebody's house and actually having, you know, Sai Bhaji was like my Achilles heel, really. So I think, you know, it's those sort of things that I think back, and I think, yeah, by God, I ate well when I was younger.
It was meant to be.
I ate really, really well. It was meant to be, but yeah. I think I only kind of, yeah, I only understood that when I actually moved in with her. And I think when I started working professionally is when I thought, well, what is it that I really want to do in food? It's all very well saying you want to do Indian food, but then, you know, I mean, even 15 years ago in the UK doing regional Indian cooking, people barely had heard of it, to be fairly honest.
So you got married when you were, how old were you then?
Oh God, no, now you're asking. I was in my late 20s when I got married.
Okay, and that's when, and I just wanted to ask for when you started your business. So don't worry, I won't give up your age.
I know, I mean, I did my business when I was 22. You know, I think by the time I was about 27, I was married. But to be honest, I didn't even know how to cook. I knew how to cook basic things, like basic chicken curry or, you know, dal.
How did you get to then cooking for people and becoming a private chef? Because I always have this conversation with most of my chef friends and people who cook about what is right, you know, going to school, learning yourself, because food is something that, you know, you can watch YouTube and learn, or you can work under a chef and learn if you like to eat, and you can learn from your grandmom. Like, it's just there's no science behind how to become a chef, right?
I mean, you know what, Pooja, when I do interviews in the UK, I think most people, it's so funny because most people want to hear your so-called very poetic story of you stood by a mother's stove learning how to put one spice at a time. Sorry to break that myth, but I did none of that, okay? As far as I was concerned, I was one of the most rebellious teenagers. And to be fairly honest, I think I still am to an extent. I still have that bit of an edge where I will do something in a way, not for the sake of challenging the status quo, but also in a way to kind of create my own niche and kind of go my own way and find my own path. And I think, you know, I mean, even with food, I mean, it was the same thing. It was not cool to actually do Indian cooking, but I think I learned on the job really quickly. I read a lot. I bought loads of books. I read loads of articles, and I cooked a heck of a lot to kind of, you know, get to the grips with the job. But I think I also traveled a shitload more than I suppose most people in their 20s traveled back to India.
Yeah.
I was just exploring India, traveling to places like Assam, Orissa, you know, Lucknow, Delhi, when it was not that cool to even travel to some of these places. Yeah. And I was just collecting recipes and trying to get in touch with people I knew, staying at hostels. And my husband to an extent was a little bit worried about me at that point.
I mean, but just I came back. 2 years ago, you made this plan to go with, you know, we were going to go together. But then didn't end up happening. So you still do this,
I still do this. And I think, you know, I always say this, that I don't ever want to stop learning. I think every year I try and make at least 2 or 3 trips to India. I mean, based on schedules and diaries and whatever the case might be. But I think that comes from a keen eye or inquisitive eye to actually learn. But I think even when I was, you know, when I started out in my career, it was essentially that. It was about actually learning more on the job than I could otherwise. You know, I think my first biggest gig was for somebody when they'd made an inquiry. This was, I think, 3 or 4 years down the line, they'd made an inquiry. It was actually a chef who was actually working on a private yacht. And I thought it was a bit of a joke, to be honest, initially. And he said, no, it's a super yacht and we don't have an Indian crew and I'm Australian and we'd just like you to actually come and kind of, you know, for one evening kind of do the cooking there. And I just thought initially it was just somebody pulling a fast one, but it kind of spinned and spiraled from there. So, you know,
Tell me, so when you were starting out, I mean, even till today, right? Like I think the opinion of what Indian food is and, you know, regional Indian food, I think that even like here in India, when in Bombay, like you have a restaurant like Bombay Canteen that's just about come up now that's championing Indian food. So what was it like for you, like even from the perspective of finding ingredients or like educating people to what regional Indian food is like?
I'm not going to lie, it was massively hard. Okay. Yeah. It was really, really hard because I think, for me, you know, I, at some point I used to go to like the Asian supermarkets and stuff, which you find in London. You can go to Brick Lane and you can go, you know, to South Hall and try and look for sort of Indian, Asian ingredients. But I mean, if you go to a regular store as well, like if you go to a Tesco or Sainsbury's, there's a good chance you would never get coriander, which is, you know, dhania being one of the most basic things in Indian cooking.
My mother like puts dhania in everything. Like it's just
exactly. Yeah. So I mean, a chutney to a garnish to whatever the case might be, but you would never get that like a basic thing. So to go from there to like now, if you go to a supermarket, you will find bhindi, you will find dhania, you'll find mint, you'll find, you know, all sorts. You'll actually find tool dal and all your spices. Yeah, I mean things that suji you'll find, which you would never have found, you know, like in, they actually have an Asian or an Eastern aisle in most supermarkets now, because obviously the demand is that much more. So when I started out, that was actually quite an issue. But also I think it was different when I started out, because I think from a restaurant perspective and also what kind of food was actually being, because don't forget, I cook for a lot of times and I do classes and everything, but I also write about, you know, do restaurants and stuff. So I think from my perspective, even just seeing the whole change of that has been massive. When we first came to UK, there was, you know, just a few, there was few and far between. There was Banaras, you know, from Agriculture. There was, Vineet Bhatia's restaurant. There was Vivek Singh doing a bit of work at the swimming club, you know, at the library. And it was like they had this French training and they had sort of kind of developed that and made, you know, Indian menus almost Frenchified. So even the approach was very different. So there was, for instance, if you wanted a basic meal, you went to a curry house, or if you wanted a really, you know, she fine dining meal, then you went to one of Atul's or Vivek's or Vineet's restaurants.
And what is it
so
like now?
If somebody, yeah, so that's the thing though. I mean, from there, which is like 15 years ago, 17 years ago to now, which, I mean, you can go to a Dishoom, for instance, you can go to a Roti Chai, you can go to a Tully Joe, or you can go to even a Bombay Bustle, and you can actually find, you know, a lunch menu for under a tenner or even £15. Mm. So you go to Dishoom, for instance, and for under a tenner, you can get dal, you can get Somali roti, and you can get chicken tikka. So I don't think that's really bad for money, you know, from a value for money point of view. But, you know, I mean, these things weren't there back then. I mean, even the number of restaurants. I mean, you talk about Bombay Canteen as being, you know, the place that's kind of, you know, kind of formidable in the movement of how we are, for, you know, seeing food in not just in Bombay, but also in India. Yeah. But I think, again, Bombay Canteen seems like a one-off. And I wish there were plenty more in Bombay or across the country doing that. I mean, I have talked to Bombay Canteen for actually not just championing regional cooking, but I also think championing local ingredients that are seasonal. But because Thomas is such a young chef and he's of course good looking and he's appealing to so many women, the point is that more people are actually receptive of it. You know what I mean? More people are receptive of it. So what I'm saying is that you kind of find that there's a younger generation kind of paving that way for it now.
So, I mean, while doing this, like, what do you think have been your biggest challenges? Did you ever have moments where you felt like, what am I even doing? Why am I doing this? Every day, right? I know, every day.
I'm sure, you know what things, it's so funny because I've actually discussed this with you on plenty of occasions. Okay? Yeah. I think from the onset, I always, always try and stick to why I do what I do. Okay, and I think for me, it's the doing bit. You know, when people say, oh my God, you do TV, you do radio, you write books and you cook, you know, for a living, that must give you so much happiness. And I think personally, all of that actually encompasses one particular task for me, which is the doing bit. Okay, so for me, the doing bit is essentially the cooking aspect of it. So when my oil's heating up, when I'm adding my spices, when I'm actually adding my onions, when I'm frying things, I'm in that moment. You know what people call, you know, from this whole spiritual, holistic trend of being in the present.
Yeah.
Yeah. In my doing, I'm actually being in the present. So I think when most people say, oh my God, we find cooking so therapeutic, I think that for me, that doing bit is my major high. When I actually get a recipe right and I'm testing it out and I think, oh my God, this has turned out to be an absolute gem. Yeah, that for me is like, I couldn't actually put it in words because I think, you know what, like, as long as I keep getting those highs of feeling good, like when I look at a plate of food and I think, damn, that tastes amazing. Yeah. In my head, I'm thinking that I'm having those conversations with myself. And I think if I keep doing that in my 60s, in my 70s, in my 80s, then yeah, I'm good.
For me as well, you know, like I think about this often. The best time is I walk in the kitchen in the morning, I put on the machine and, you know, just the sound of the egg whites going in and making the meringue and then mixing the macaron. It's like it's like being in a zone.
It's like a one step at a time.
Yeah, it's like being in a zone and it's like just, it's that moment where you're actually in the moment and you're nowhere else. And I think that's what baking is for me.
I mean, see, you know, in doing the job that we do, I think every day is a hustle. Okay, I'm not going to lie. And there are plenty of times I actually think to myself, should I just quit while I'm ahead and just kind of pack it in?
When was the last time you thought that?
Oh, God.
Tell me. Be honest with me.
Not so long ago. I think 3 months ago.
What happened?
I think it's a mix of everything. You know, when you're trying, because we were filming the mini series, I was trying to get, you know, we've just launched the app, the new Indian Recipes app in Feb. So that's kind of going crazy. Then I'm writing the new book. So I think all of that together, and then trying to juggle diary days for like client events, cookery classes, and planning your whole year ahead. You know what I mean? So I think the whole, your mind space, you only have this one mind. The poor brain kind of like freezes or, you know, gets fried completely.
And plus then you have your personal life too. You have
I think, you know, most people don't actually know that I actually have a 10-year-old.
Yeah.
So I juggle being a mother. I juggle being a wife. Juggle being a homemaker. And I have a beagle. So yeah, I have a 2.5-year-old beagle, the most important baby of our life. So I think when I juggle all that, those moments can kind of get me slightly more anxious. But I think, I don't know, maybe it's an age thing or maybe it's an experience thing. One of the two will always help you out in one of these, you know, situations that trouble you the most, because, you know, either way, I've kind of learned to a very large extent to handle it, because I find I still have like the 10% or 20% anxiety where I feel like, oh God, like, how am I going to cope with this, that, or the other? And, you know, you can't be at two places the same. I can't be a good mother and I can't be a good working woman. So one has got to give. So I can't do a school pickup, or I can't be at his plays or dramas when I'm actually, you know, filming something, and vice versa, if I've got to not do something. You know, so I think those are my challenges essentially on a day-to-day basis. But I think when I'm having those moments, I think the best way to actually kind of rethink, like my husband, you know, I have a really good sounding board at home because I have a family that kind of is, for me, balances everything out. Because I have that, I kind of feel like it balances, you know, the shitty days out, really.
Yeah, and I think that's what most people don't see, right? They see the exterior. They see, like, all these things that you said. Oh, like, you have a book, you have a mini-series, you have a show. You're friends with Jamie Oliver, man. You know?
I'm not friends with Jamie Oliver.
Yes, you are. Don't lie.
I worked with him, yeah.
Same thing.
I worked with his team for, the best part of 12 years now. 12 years ago, we did one of the first events for the Food Revolution Foundation, which he actually kind of runs and heads. And yeah, then we did a lot of work with Food too. But you know what? I have to be honest, and I think you'll know that more than anybody, that your best laid plans can go completely, you know, up in smoke. And when you least expect the things happen. So even when we filmed the videos for Food too, he wasn't meant to actually film with me. He just loved Indian food and he requested the production house and he said, listen, I'd like to actually film with her. And that's how we kind of got to know each other. And, you know, and I think now more than anything, I hugely respect his work, hugely respect what he does. But I kind of look at him as a mentor and somebody who's always checking in and looking out and, you know, keeping an eye on what
I'm doing. Yeah, I would say he's a friend, Mon. I would say he's a friend. How did the cookbook happen?
So I think for the last like 7-8 years, we've actually been asked, well, I've been asked to do a cookbook for a while. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how it works like in India, but of course here, you know, you have your agent and you have publishers and you can either approach a publisher directly. And I've had loads of them actually asking me for a long time. I think for me, it was always important to actually work with the right team. And I think for me, I think inherently I'm, you know, I didn't see it like that even 10 years ago, but I kind of know now, even from a work perspective, if it's not going to feed my soul well, then I don't tend to do it. It's as simple as that.
Because a book is work, man. People don't understand that.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, you know, because I had 2 months to actually write, test and cook the recipe.
Yeah.
That was my deadline.
Wow, yeah.
And we had to shoot the book in 2 weeks. So basically out of the 120 recipes in the book, you have 90 images done in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So yeah, even when I was testing the recipes, I was on an average doing between 4 and 5 recipes tested every single day.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, to make it worse for myself, I think what I thought was I have a test kitchen and I have industrial ovens and industrial hobs. And I think my logic always was, this is going to be a domestic cookbook. This is a cookbook that families are going to buy. So if I actually go by hobs and ovens that are, you know, industrial, they're not going to be accurate in terms of time. So basically, I just moved the entire testing to my house. So you can imagine the fun for my family. testing, you know, 4 recipes a day. I mean, I have, Pooja, for the life of me, had moments where I had sat on the floor and cried my eyes out because a pulao hasn't turned out right. And tested it 8 times in the same day.
Oh my God.
And also got my butcher to shut shop at 10 o'clock at night because I needed my 6th batch of, like, you know, a kilo of meat because I was just struggling.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's those stories that I think that people tend to not hear.
I mean, it's like I just finished testing for my eggless bacon book. And
yeah,
you know,
oh
like
God.
Oh my,
like, eggless.
Yeah, eggless. But the thing is that you know, you have an idea of how some recipes are going to turn out. Some of them you think will be really good, and then it's a complete disaster. And I was doing like 6 to 8 recipes a day, and imagine like I wasn't eating sugar the whole time. So
how do you do it? You're like my hero.
No. So this is the disgusting part that I don't really like to talk about, but it's like wine tasting, go figure. What are you gonna do? Like, I have to test 120 recipes in 2 months. Like, no way can I eat everything. And then
but I was really lucky because I think, you know, every publisher varies and their budgets are hugely different. So I had, you know, a food stylist on site. I had, you know, a massively talented photographer. Helen Cathcart did the most stunning images for Indian Kitchen. Yeah, and I think also I had, you know, a really good team kind of helping with, you know, styling it. The props were amazing. So it all looked, the finished product looked well. And I think that's what I say. If it doesn't feed my soul, then I think project that I tend to do.
It does, and you can tell. Because I spoke to Harshit, which is your publisher in India, right, for the book?
Yeah.
And so it's the same publisher for my second book. And they weren't telling me that because the book is slightly expensive, it's hardbound, they weren't sure how it's going to do in India, but it killed it. Like, your book did amazing. And
yeah, but it's so funny because even when Hodo initially mentioned, we're actually publishing in India, and I was like, you are mad. I said, don't do it. I said, no, because listen, okay, I'm fully aware. I moved away a long time ago. I think I just had this notion that I'd move to the West, and I think most Indians would be wondering, well, what is this Indian girl moving to, you know, to the UK, telling us Indians how to cook? But then, you know, I came to yours, and I did a few things.
We did a workshop together.
Yeah. And I actually kind of got that inkling that actually there's so many people who are
younger.
Actually,
these people don't know anything. There's a whole bunch of them that are useless. I can teach
them. You know what I mean? Like, like when you're in the food business, you kind of...
I still remember you made that pineapple chutney. I can still taste it.
Yeah.
I can still taste it. It was that incredible.
I mean, your first book is my go-to for that chocolate loaf cake. It's amazing because I don't bake, and that's the hard truth. But I have a child who insists on baking, and he just uses yours. But I think, like, when I think about it, you know more about your craft than any of us would. And I think vice versa. Like, yeah. I probably would know a lot more than someone who's living in Bombay or living in Delhi. Because I think, in a way, they wouldn't go to places like Orissa or, you know, even any other places where they want to kind of identify or find out more about that cuisine in particular.
Yeah, and also I think you make it approachable, right? Like, that's, I don't get afraid when, normally Indian cooking, like, it scares me. But then I open your book and it's like, oh, this is doable. There are like 6 ingredients. It's not so tough.
Yeah, but
it looks easy.
You know, I think when I did that, I think essentially I did want to go for that idea of it being accessible and approachable. And I think I don't want people to ever think that Indian food is daunting. And I think that for me goes hand in hand in actually discovering the recipes from places that most people haven't heard of.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, in Orissa they do a dish called santula, which is actually a vegetarian dish which is made with milk and a liver water. It's like a thin stew with absolutely delicious veggies. But, you know, when I remember sharing the recipe with one of the magazines I worked with, and it's the simplicity of something like that is kind of what blows your mind. But then because it's, you know, Orion, and you think, like, you know, people would have not heard of it. It's still quite simple. So I think just because it's, like, I have a couple of Afghani recipes in Indian kitchen in the book. And, you know, I think it's all of those things which make me think that I don't want this typical same old things all the time. Because then if I do Palak Paneer, then the diamond doesn't say, well, we've done that before. You know what I mean? So I think even for me, it's got to be that education of trying to understand and find out and learn that much more out of it, really. So I think in preserving and pushing forward, you know, recipes that I know exist as part of homes across India is where I feel like I thrive the most. So not only do I want to make them accessible, but at the same time, I also want to be able to kind of, you know, make sure that they are recipes that people haven't really heard of, but also want to be able to give it a try. Like you said, like if it's a short list of ingredients, and you really want that.
Yeah. And my future best friend, Mindy Kaling, cooks from your book.
What do you mean, future best friend?
My future best friend.
Your best friend.
No, Chrissy Teigen is my best friend currently.
Yeah, you have too many best friends who, like, need to be my future best friends, to be fairly honest.
What does that feel like? I mean, you have Mindy Kaling cooking from your book and posting a picture. Like, what's that like?
Crazy. Slightly crazy and slightly overwhelming. She's been in touch a couple of times, and she said, I mean, a few times she's been in London, and she's asked for recommendations of restaurants. And, you know, I mean, also, when she kind of initially said, oh, I bought a copy of a book, I thought, okay, she's probably just being polite.
Yeah. But my future best friend is really amazing, so she's...
Yeah, she is really amazing. Trust me. I'm a huge, huge Mindy Kaling fan. But I think, like, when I saw, like, she was cooking for the book, but the thing is, like, you know what, Pooja, I've had so many people do it, including whether it's Jamie or it's Heston or it's, you know, even B. Sanghvi in India and stuff like that. People actually, even Vikas Khanna, for instance, people saying amazing things for the book, I think always flows and blows my mind amazingly. Like,
it makes it worth it, right? Like, the crying for that eight time the plow didn't work out.
Yeah, makes it totally worth it. But I think, I mean, I think, the biggest compliment for me actually comes from when just lay people actually kind of say, oh my God, like, it's so funny. We were actually in New York, last month, and there was a little quaint restaurant which looked absolutely stunning, and this Indian girl walked out, and she was dressed head to toe looking just impeccable. And it was raining a little bit, so she was trying to fold her umbrella. So I walked past her, and she said, oh my God, she said, I need to stop you. Are you Monica? And I thought, shit, I look shit. So I think it scared me a little, but I think when she stopped me, she said, I have to just stop you and tell you what a godsend your book is. Now,
wow.
You know, when things like that happen, those are my pinch me moments. Yeah. Because you know what? I think writing a book, the whole process of doing it is so isolated. Yeah. I was just going to say that. It's an isolating process. Yes. And you don't know where that book's going to turn up. You don't. You don't know who's cooking from it. You don't know who's baking from it. You don't know. I think what we seem to forget as authors and as writers and people in food is how empowering it is to actually be able to have the platform to be able to kind of say, okay, fine, I'm putting this out there for all of you in the world to kind of see and read and cook from. And oh my God, to even get that kind of, I think it's almost a blessing to be able to have people cook and bake from your books and feel like, my God, this turned out amazing.
That's amazing. We're on to the last question. What is the big dream? What do you hope for yourself?
Oh, God. I can't say that.
No, give me the real, no sugarcoat answer, okay?
No sugarcoat answer. You know, when I started, the big dream was to write books and to, yeah, just be established in food. And so I think in a way I'm living that big dream. But then, you know, as you keep achieving a certain sort of milestone, you move on to the next and you move on to the next, and you move on to the next. And it kind of evolves slightly. So I think the big dream really now is to kind of, you know, embody what I do and kind of just essentially celebrate a cuisine that I know is inclusive and embracing and kind of showcasing that diversity. But beyond that, I think the most important thing for me, Pooj, is the big dream really is for people to say, well, Indian cooking means, you know, Monica Gawarden. I'm hugely bold in saying that, but I have no qualms in saying that, because I think also what I see that doing is kind of, you know, paving the way for more people in food. Yeah. I wish I could say there's this one specific thing that I actually want to achieve, because, you know, you can plan all you want and
we're gonna go cook for Oprah, Mon. That's a big dream. You know this.
I think the main thing really is to see more and more people cooking Indian food. And I think there's, you know, just going back to that, there's this whole sort of debate about cultural appropriation at the moment, whether it's in food or fashion or music or whatever the case might be. But I think what people need to, you know, you have to kind of not look at it from a negative point of view, but kind of shift the paradigm slightly, because I personally feel like as if when you actually push forward and you're celebrating a cuisine, that means it's more inclusive as opposed to being exclusive.
Yeah, super. Thank you so much. No, thank you. And we'll keep working on that dream of, you know, cooking for Oprah.
I'll hold you to that, because you're supposed to take
You're like, Pooch, that's your dream. Stop putting it on me. But we'll make it up.
That's our dream, because you're taking me with you. Oh. You promised me that. So I'm good.
Let's do this. Thank you so much, Monica. Thank you. That was Monica Govardhan. Next week, I'm talking to my friend, Chef Kelvin Chung from Bastion in Mumbai. We chat about learning to deal with failure, his gangster life, and his deadly drink, the pickleback.
No Sugarcoat is a Made in India production. This episode is produced by Sharanya Subramanian, edited by Soundman. Studio setup by Apoorv Isaac, aka Lala. Sound equipment by Artiste Studios. Our theme music is Rhythm Maker by the band Haiku. For more information, check out madeinindia.in.